You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots listener-supported solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in Fairfield, Iowa, on this first day of FairFest 2015, which is June 19th, 2015. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn, who's holding a beautiful book in her hand.
Yes. Yeah. And it's a beautiful day. It is a gorgeous day out. 77 degrees, low humidity.
Iowa's always like this, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, there's a quote in here.
Think we can fool people?
There's a quote in this book that's just fantastic. The wind only blows here twice a year, 6 months from the south and 6 months from the north. It's in this
book.
So
what are we looking at today?
We're looking at this book, which is Soul External, Rediscovering the Great Blue Heron. And if no one has ever seen a great blue heron, which I have not, I'm looking forward to someday seeing one, because from this description in this book, they must be a magnificent bird.
And the author is?
The author is Stephen Semkin, and Stephen is the owner of Ice Cube Press in North Liberty, Iowa, and they have given us many, many wonderful books.
Yes, and we've interviewed quite a few authors. We've had Steve on before. Let's give a little intro.
Okay, the Ice Cube Press began publishing in 1993 to focus on how to live with the natural world and to better understand how people can best live together in the communities they share and inhabit. What a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. Using the literary arts to explore life and experiences in the heartland of the United States. And they have been recognized by many, many authors. And I'm sure many authors have gotten their start here at Ice Cube Press and owe their success to them.
Absolutely.
So this book is a collaboration of Stephen Semkin and Andrew Driscoll, who is the layout and illustrations. And it's a magnificent book. It's an most unusual book.
It is.
But it's magnificent. And the is he chasing the wild heron, the wild blue heron.
Well, welcome back to Writer's Voices, Steve.
Hi.
It's really great to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
So
I've been dodging around road construction all day, trying to get people places, and I finally am. If I cut out every once in a while, I'll tell you it's because I'm on the side of the road. But I got it to where I can get 4 or 5 bars of service, because normally I would do a landline. But.
Right. Are you close to home, or are you traveling?
I'm pretty close, but I'm telling you, there's like 3 more detours before I get home. So I was like, I just better stop. Find a shade spot and enjoy this great day that it apparently is going on all over the place.
Yeah.
Now, you live in North Liberty, Iowa?
Yeah.
Which is?
It's got about, two cornfields are left between Iowa City and North Liberty.
And there's a lot of condos.
It'll be part of Iowa City eventually, won't it?
Well, I do live in one of the older houses, so you don't have to feel that sorry.
Well, that's
a lot of condos there, though, that's for sure.
What brought you to North Liberty? Have you lived there all your life, or did you come there later?
Not really. I grew up in Iowa City, so I suppose you could say North Liberty, Johnson County, Iowa, for a large majority of my 51 years. The time that I wasn't in Iowa, I was pretty much gawking at the Blue Heron Rookery.
Which is located in Kansas.
Yeah, it's outside of Lawrence, Kansas, yeah. In an unknown spot. I mean, it really wouldn't matter if I told you where it was right now, because you probably wouldn't be able to find it. But it was probably about 15 miles north of Lawrence, so kind of north of the Kansas River and maybe an hour and a half from Kansas City.
So Soul External is I wrote in the blog post on KRUUFM.com. It's
right.
Kind of part memoir, part natural mythology, but mixed in with a whole bunch of other things. It's sort of a unique book. So
we'd really
like to hear how this whole concept and this book came to be.
Well, yeah, we got an hour, right?
Right. Yes, we do. You're on.
You might as well set down your phone. Mm-hmm. Let's set down your questions. Well, I mean, when I wrote this book, I don't think of it as being unusual at all, of course. It's kind of comes as a surprise to me when people think that it's somewhat unusual or unique, because honestly, it's just this idea of the natural world and what I bring to it when I go there. And another thing about this book that is kind of essential is that you definitely see two names on the front cover, and so there's no way this is my book. This is absolutely a co-collaboration between Andrew Driscoll and myself. You know, the title is something we thought about. The going to this, and I'll explain what a rookery is as we go along, because I heard one of you say you haven't seen a heron before, so for me to jump right ahead and start telling you what a rookery is probably kind of ridiculous. But I guess I'm always, when I see something outside, I see the obviousness of it, but I also think about it as far as, you know, what else is there. It's kind of easy to see an oak tree, but once you identify it, there's a lot more to it than that. And so the way I go about writing about herons is I see them, and then what is that? What do I think of when I see them? There's a magazine and a group called the Orion Society, and there's this Peter Sauer, who has passed away, but he had written something about a version of this book that I really think helps people understand it, because they're kind of a group that focuses on natural history. And he had written, "I've been becoming more and more impatient, wondering where nature writing might go next. This book has helped me think about this with what feels like greater clarity. Mythological natural history is at least as useful, and perhaps a lot more useful, than scientifically derived natural history for writing about another species." And I guess that's kind of what I was shooting for, is this is weaving all that we know about sort of this web of life together. Thoughts and observations. I don't want to get too esoteric, so maybe I should kind of pause while you ask more questions along the way.
Well, in the book, it seems like you had quite an obsession with herons.
Yeah.
Is that an accurate description?
That's an accurate description. I mean, I'm not really sure where it came from. And I'm pretty sure it's Monica.
Wait, yes, yeah.
Talking to Monica, right?
Right.
I can't remember. Tell me.
Monica and Caroline.
Okay, and so you haven't seen a heron. I bet that you probably have.
No, I have.
They're usually in rivers, and they're about 4.5 feet tall, and they're kind of grayish blue. They have those curved necks. And it's just that I think what fascinated me in this particular case was when we were in Lawrence, we lived along the Kansas River, and I would see just an occasional heron out along the shore. And also, if you go kayaking or canoeing or something, you'll oftentimes see one kind of by itself. And themselves, I've always enjoyed seeing them because they're not because of the color and the way they fly and the way their wings move. But when I was told, I think literally Andy and I were told about this place together. My wife was in the art department at KU, and Andy was also, and someone had suggested going to check out this rookery of herons. And at this point, I'm telling you, I'm still not that obsessed with herons other than I like seeing them as much as I would like seeing an oriole or an indigo bunting or something. I just like, wow, that's a unique-looking bird. And they told us to go down this road and follow this gravel road, and you take another gravel road, and pretty soon you'll end up at a driveway, kind of an old driveway with a no trespassing sign. And when you get to that, that's exactly where you want to park, and you want to go right on past that no trespassing sign. They're just kind of like, and I think they had said, like, you know, don't worry about it if someone asks you why you're there. Just let them know that you're with the Wildlife Division or you're with University of Kansas or some sort of, you know, be confident in what you have to say, but it's going to be okay if you go in. And still, we're still just like, well, I guess we found the right spot, and so we're journeying in. following along a little creek, and kind of marveling at the sycamore trees, and it's early spring, and there's, you know, some iris and some daffodils blooming, and still, I'm not obsessed with herons yet. I'm just out for a cool walk, because I don't know what awaits me. And I think that we are mostly fascinated by this large sycamore tree, which plays a part in the book, but not at this point. And then finally, I know that we started to hear some peeps and some light noises. And then as you get a little bit closer, we're talking like 10, 15 yards at a time at this point. Then one of us looked up and it's just like, oh my God, what? There's these huge 4-foot birds that I at least consider to be individual birds. Probably like 80 or 90 or 100 of them just going in and out of the tops of these large sycamore trees.
Ooh, wow.
Part of the charm for us, at least myself anyway, was that I was probably more obsessed with sycamore trees. And I'm pretty sure they have them in Fairfield. There's not as many in Iowa as there are down in Kansas and Missouri, but they're the trees. They have kind of white trunks, and they flake, and they're kind of greenish white.
Yeah, there are a few around, but not many. Yeah,
and so they're really big, and so the herons are flying in and out, but the nests are way up in the top, and they're like eagle nests. A lot of people understand eagles. They kind of layer the sticks on top of each other year after year. They're not making these out of grass for one season. And so I think at that point, I know that we all sort of stood there in disbelief and sat down on the log at first and just watched these giant birds coming in and out. And they're kind of like, I make references to angels, or I'll make references to prehistoric animals standing there. And so just the sight of the birds to start out with, and I don't think you get a full obsession if you're just doing it off sight. But then it became the noises, because I also hadn't heard herons make a noise other than just a simple kind of just a squawk or a frock or something that just kind of like, leave me alone, I'm flying on down river.
Yeah.
But then it turns out they make, you know, dozens of variety of noises. And so we can hear the baby ones kind of peeping away up in the nest. And so at that point, we're getting even more intense on this, just staring at them, like kind of looking at each other like, oh my God, can you believe what's above us? It's a complete surprise, really, to discover so much activity above you. And pretty much after that, then it was either that trip or one, maybe a couple days later, we went back. And we were walking underneath the nest a little bit, and then you could see like the bones and small ones that had fallen out, and you could smell what it was like there. And so I would say at that point I became pretty much all things heron. And just like, I think it's mostly just because of the surprise of what was awaiting. If someone had even described it to me ahead of time, I may have been less obsessed with it, but I think it just was such an utter surprise to me from something that was one of the last creatures that I expected to surprise me, really. I think that's where it started.
How did this book, this little book that you found in that bookstore fit in, that you had to cut the pages of?
About the book that we found there.
Uh-huh.
Well, I'll tell you a little thing. See, I'm kind of, there's two ways I want to answer your question. Is that one, how am I going to do this without, like, doing spoiler alerts?
I guess I've always
admired a lot of magic realism and South American authors. And one that's really helped, that I really had a big influence on was Borges, B-O-R-G-E-S. And he has two first names, but most people just know him that way. And the thing that I've always been marveled with at the way that he writes is that you can't tell if something is real or not. And so a lot of his books are short stories. And when I first started reading him, I constantly kept looking at the back and the front of the book to see, I was like, this is not fiction. This can't possibly be fiction because I'm so convinced. And but it is fiction. And so that's something that is always, I've always been like that idea of, because to me, but like when I tell you that I don't see this book as being unusual, I don't necessarily see the fiction I write as being nonfiction or vice versa at all. And so the book that's found in Lucas, Kansas is, well, I'll tell you a lot about the format of the book and why I wrote it the way I did, but, you know, that book is not a real thing. That's me. I'm deciding a way to, you know, that's a real place in Kansas, the Garden of Eden. But there's also a river there, the river that I have mentioned. I'll think of the river in a second. But, I mean, what I'm doing is I'm trying to introduce the idea of I'm trying to mix fact and fiction, of course.
Right.
And I do like small bookstores, and that is the book I wish I could buy. And so, I mean, and that's the way for
but
me to introduce
so real.
The book. So, yeah, I guess I don't really want to tell you that it's a real book, but, I mean, I guess it's not, but on the other hand, it totally is, because those are the, because what I'm doing there is I'm using that as a vehicle to explore the bird, I mean, explore the heron more. Because the things that I pick out that were written about in that book are things that are true. Probably the one of the best comments that Andy and I got for this book was from, because one thing that was really important to us was that any time that you find out about the color of the heron, or you find out about the location where it lives, or the nest, or its height, or the way it walks, that stuff is all totally accurate. As far as I know, there was only a couple books on great blue herons out there, and one of them is by Robert Butler, who's a senior Canadian wildlife, I guess the equivalent of our Department of Natural Resources, and he's one of the research scientists and had written a book called The Great Blue Herons, and so I purposely sent him, you know, an early draft of this book to see if everything that was in the book was true, like these birds do live in these nests, and these nests are created with sticks, and they're mating rituals by passing sticks to each other. That is what they do. And he had written us back and said, you know, it's amazing. He's like, everything you say is true about the size of the birds and the way their eggs look. And so that was really important to us. And he went on to say, the lyrical narrative draws the reader into a mythical world of hermits, herons, and heretics. He celebrates the web of life through creative expression. But I guess there's a certain line where you're kind of like, is this too far out for anyone to believe? So this book never dips past, there's certain parameters that it never goes beyond, if you think of it as like an up and down wave. So you're kind of going, you know, there's super reality at one on one scale, and then there's sort of far out magic realism on the other extreme. And I don't think it always waves between the two. But some of the things that people think are far out are absolutely not far out at all.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. The title itself is Soul External, which is referred to in The Golden Bough, which is George Frazier, has a whole thing about old-time magic and old-time beliefs and old-time rituals. And one of them was the thought of placing a soul external. And so there's been plenty of culture that has believed that you could place a soul outside itself. And to us, that seemed like a great... I think Andy called me up and told me about that. I was like, oh, man, that is absolutely right on. Because the place... Because it was an obsession with the birds, the place itself became a unique spot in and of itself. And so the thought that these birds were somehow souls and they were placing something outside themselves and returning each year, to me that's not that far out an idea, because it's certainly not a unique idea. It's I often tell writers, because I also, you know, publish other people's books, and I tell people all the time that claiming to be unique and claiming to be the first one that's ever done anything it's really not a unique, it's not an envious spot to be. What you want to discover in yourself, what you want to discover in yourself is how you fit in with the tradition of writing. Mm. And I feel like this book fits in with the long tradition of environmental writing. I've read almost everything Barry Lopez has written. To me, he straddles the real and the imagined all the time. There's another guy, David Abram, who has written a book on magic and the natural world. And he introduces magic and ways of seeing the world that people have been, you know, are using for thousands of years. I think of a lot of the times as I'm explaining the world through the senses and through the elements of fire, water, earth, air, and spirit. I mean, that's certainly not a unique way to look at the world, but someone that's simply into bird identification will probably find soul external a little far out for them. I'm surprised. I mean,
well, part of what makes it unusual, I think, is well, first there is the mix of fact and fiction. I wasn't sure reading it how much of, you know, the things that you describe in as happening to you actually happened, but of course there, right. It was easy to kind of identify some of it, like, you know, the
well, I mean, that's actually my goal. So
good.
I was hopefully not. I mean, there's a lot of effort that went into that. Someone not to make it totally clear. I mean, I saw that as like the one of the main points of trying to figure out how to put it together. And, I mean, I guess it's not that easy, but certainly what I was aiming for. I was going to mention one other thing real quick.
Sure.
The tradition of the book itself, because we open with a quote from Ovid, and it's book 15. At the very beginning, it'll talk about the town of Ardea. And the Latin name for the heron is the Ardea Herodia. Herodias. And
oh, really?
So you have at the beginning of this Ovid, you have the town of Ardea, which is a clear reference to the bird, and then you have later on in this passage the city is, the city is burned, but out from out the embers comes the bird itself. And so you have once again a reference to the and I'm not an Ovid scholar by any means, but you know, that's pretty self-explanatory in and of itself, that you can start the book with the reference. It literally uses the bird as a kind of a symbol coming out, and I don't know. When I read something like that, I don't see this book as being outside of the tradition.
No, of course not. And in fact, you incorporate a great deal of literary tradition into
right,
the book with quotes.
When people say it's weird and it's unusual, I guess I'm not going to disagree. But then I think sometimes people think it's even weirder, like I'm trying to pull their leg. It's that unusual, because I guess I just don't see it that way. But I mean, you're not the only person that has wondered about some of the fact and the fiction blurring, and so I take that as a great compliment, because the writers that I read a lot are, and that's the part that I'm really trying to figure out myself.
Well, the prayers at the end, the prayers to honor the great blue heron, are really prayers to honor creation, to me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and they were wonderful, just wonderful.
Thanks. I've had a number of people say that. Andy, I think he told me several times that's one of his favorite parts. And I had I guess I just thought that was a natural conclusion somehow to the book itself, with the somehow, if you're going to immerse them into your life that way, then that's going to require a slightly different way of honoring where and how you live. And so they weren't very hard to write, because it seemed like at that point that was the only thing left that needed to be said. I guess that marks a good way to end a book. I suppose to end it that way.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Steve Semkin, the author of Soul External, Rediscovering the Great Blue Heron, and also the founder of Ice Cube Press at North Liberty, Iowa. One of the other things I think that is unusual about the book, though, is the format and the use of typography and kind of poetic elements of you know, there's certain, I don't know what you call the type of poetry where the placement of the words on the page is an important element of the poem, and that is something that you're using in here too. You've got
part of it is, I mean, you want to have a certain way of presenting the way the book is read to a certain extent, and so you place a word in certain spots, or if you break a line in a certain spot, that controls the way that a person will be able to read it. So if you stretch a word out, of course it's going to take longer to read that word. I'm an amateur writer at best, and so, and I tell people all the time, once you care about being a writer, it's incredibly hard to even be a bad writer. Like, the things that I'm trying to do in the book, you know, that's debatable whether I even come close to pulling them off. But something that I try and do within it is if the scene is, I mean, I try and match the sounds of the words with this, what you're describing, or if it's a scene that I want to get through quickly, I'll try and use faster words. And I think breaking the words into, like, I love page 22, and for people that don't have the book, they'll just have to get it so they can see page 22.
Right.
You know, I have the bird saying, you know, flock, and this huge, the word is just spread out on the page, and it says flock, but yet it's displayed in a way that makes it somewhere between confusing and simple all the time. Make a great front of a baseball hat or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
I guess it's just two people trying to present something the way they want it to. And so the two of us really work together on, and Andy gets all credit for design and page layout and that sort of thing.
Well, is the layout on page 30, is that a heron, the way the words are laid out? Is that?
I think that's just the idea of wandering in. It's the Solomon Rivers one I run. I always liked that. And I think, well, I have to ask him, actually. But that's the one, the hint number two chapter.
Right.
I think it's the wandering. And, I mean, honestly, if you asked him, you'll get different answers than me, which is exactly how it should be. So I guess I won't really speak for him on that one. But I always read that as wandering into a place and then focusing in.
Ah, okay.
Because we pull into the center of the village.
Okay, what about page 48? That one really jumped out at me.
48 is one of my all-time favorite things, yeah. That's my favorite part of the book is this. As I told you on our way in, we sort of marveled at this, at the sycamore trees and kind of the creek and everything. And there is this mammoth, hollowed-out sycamore tree. And I think at some point I get to read for 4 or 5 minutes.
Yeah, do you want to read now? Do you want to read this part?
Yeah. I'll just describe this thing, this photo. The drawing, the illustration is kind of a hollowed-out tree with a spiral. It's repeated throughout the book, this yellow spiral. And I don't know where some of the ideas come from either, but that's the thing about being obsessed, but... this is the beginning of a chapter called Ages Ago, and I'll read maybe a page or so. This one goes start Ages Ago. On a silent spring evening during the Miocene, some 14 million years ago, amidst the bloom of hardy woodland flowers, what appeared to be a constellation of great blue herons began forming in the northern sky. Great blue herons were being hurled out of the dense middle of the earth, one by one, through the hollow trunk of a giant sycamore tree. Bird after bird heaved in tight and curled up fashion, where they became visible against the backdrop of the Milky Way. This release of birds went on 19 hours without interruption, each bird slightly different from another, just as every wind that blows is an entirely unique movement. Some great blues had blotches of crimson on their bills, others long white plume feathers, still others were glossed in powdery layers of fossilized sea pulp. Having been concocted in alchemical fashion through the fusion of earthly elements, way down in darkness where gold is believed to form, congeal, churn, and develop so slowly, the great blue herons were being released from out of the earth to embark upon a journey that would involve living in a sacred realm, just above the ground, very next to the clouds, in sight of the sun, while resting on a pillow of invisible air amidst the tips of tree branches and the soft cushion of a riverbed. One could hardly turn these birds into angels, but there is no doubt they live in the third realm of the spheres, in a spot where they can hear and see the gods. That's probably a good spot. But even in that paragraph, or those couple, that page, I mean, I'm kind of trying to weave fact and fiction in there, because the Miocene is the oldest time that the herons are known to have been found. And at that time of year, the hardy woodland flowers are out at that time of year. And of course, I mean, I don't know if herons came to birth out of that hollow sycamore tree or not, but because of the place that we were, and because of the evidence of where we were, that seemed like a perfectly reasonable explanation for the birth of anything, because how do we actually know anything anyway? And so that hollow tree where they're being put out into the world, of course, is a journey that no one knows, but that illustration on that page, I've always just loved that as a sort of an origin spot where things are spiraling out of. I love this radio show. I can give as long answers.
Yeah, we love it too, and we're really happy to have you here. And just if you've just tuned in, this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Steve Simkin, author of Soul External, Rediscovering the Great Blue Heron. And
I know you didn't even ask me a question yet, but I flipped the page. The one thing that I really liked about writing a book like this is sort of kind of a natural history, spiritual look at the world. It's so much fun to try and come up with things that... Like, I have a line in there somewhere, I think, because I have a list of different saints and angels and sayings that they might have. And I always remember one that I wrote was like, someone had said, listening, one of the saints says, listening doesn't mean waiting for your chance to speak. I mean, it's so much fun to be able to say things that it's kind of a writer's challenge. You have ideas, and you know they're related, and then you have to figure out how you're going to integrate them into the book. And so it's also just, as an author and a writer, I always hope that people are enjoying what they're writing, because in the end, that's always the most fun to a certain extent.
Yeah. Now, as a publisher, mm-hmm. You know, a couple questions. One is, how many of your own books have you published?
Well, I started out, and, you know, this could become another long conversation about self-publishing, but when I started in 93, 92, I'm glad I get to give you a long answer. I started out with the idea that I just wanted to be a writer. And so then I started a newsletter, which was called Sycamore Roots, which kind of, I've hinted at how much I like that tree. And then it was over time, and Andy was actually part of the first book that I had ever done in 1995. I had shared some writing that I'd done with him, and I remember him saying, you know, I think you have a book. This would be great. I'll help you design it. And I guess my impatience with the world is kind of a good thing, because I decided that that would be a good idea. And I tell writers now that they should be really glad that I'd self-published my first two books. If I hadn't have done that, I absolutely would never have known what to do. I made a lot of mistakes. And so really, it's been those first two books that I had done on my own that really allowed me to go on and do, you know, I've done over 100 books for other people now.
Wow.
And without those first two, absolutely, I would be a less capable press now than if I hadn't have done that. And so I guess I kind of have a little different take on self-publishing. But at first, I was kind of self-conscious about it, like a lot of people are, because there's that you did it yourself, which I realize is something to be proud of, but in the publishing world, a lot of the times it means a lot of other things.
Right.
That no one else accepted it, or it means that you had, you know, it means that it's not as high quality.
Right.
But it also means that you're going to have to start at the beginning to figure out where to sell it and how to spread the word. And So I've learned how to do all those things, and I frequently tell people if they ask me my secrets to success, and I often say, well, A, it's debatable that I'm that successful, even though I'm still doing it. But the other thing is, you know, without a degree in writing, without a degree in marketing, without a degree in advertising, without a degree in web design and all that, I mean, somehow I've still made it work. And so I guess it's kind of, if you're enthusiastic and motivated enough, that that's kind of the degree that you need the most, is how to see what you do through.
Well, do you think that I don't know if there's a lot of new independent presses coming up these days or not, but I kind of have the feeling that most of them probably do start with somebody wanting to publish their own work.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that makes the most sense to do it that way.
Yeah.
And I think just people lose sight of that because there's still kind of a knock on self-publishing to this day, even though, I mean, I had someone the other day tell me, boy, getting your sole external was like getting a gift from Blake. And I was like, hey, guess what? William Blake self-published his own writing.
So,
I mean, you're definitely in good company. But there is, I mean, I don't know.
Well, the issue with self-publishing, of course, self-publishing is much easier to do than when you did it in 1995 because
That's
you had
true.
To...
You do offset then.
Yeah, you had to buy. How many books did you have to buy?
If you didn't start out with, you know, 1,500 to 2,500, then it really wasn't worth doing. And, of course, now, you know, I do all kinds of stuff. So you could start with, you know, most people, if they self-publish now, I would guess they'd either, A, probably... A lot of people only do e-books, and then some people do print-on-demand.
Right.
And so that, you know, you can do 50 or 100 or 300, whatever.
Or I mean, two. I mean, you can do...
Wrong with any of that.
Yeah.
Great way to save paper.
Yeah, and not have to have a garage full of books.
Right. And so, I mean, I guess I haven't done a book of my own in a long time, and so...
Well, that's what I was wondering, too, because I don't remember having seen one of your books since we've been talking.
I mean, it's pretty unusual, and it's not really that it's a lot of things go into that. I mean, one, it's hard to write a book, and, I mean, this book, I mean, we started going to this rookery, and, I mean, I kind of had the feeling if Andy and I got together again and someone offered us, you know, $100,000 and said, do you want to redo this book, we'd do it again. Because probably constantly come up with changes to make. But if we probably started this book over 20 years ago, and it took us this long between jobs and moving and sort of re-inspiration and having time to work together and also just kind of let it percolating and figuring out how we wanted it to be. I mean, if this is the only book I ever done in my life, I'd still be proud of it. And so...
Well, you ended up with a beautiful book.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I was a little worried that other authors would be like, hey, wait, why don't I get that kind of paper? And
have they?
Hey, when I get an artist like that, I'm like, hey, Ian, you published books for 23 years. You can have one, too.
Yeah.
And I mean, I have had books published by different publishers, and I've learned a lot from them as far as how they approach things. And one thing that, and it doesn't affect me on this book, but it has affected me over time, is that having the dream of wanting to be a writer in the first place has definitely made me a different style of publisher than someone that just went into publishing either because they liked other people's stories or because they wanted to see if they could market books. Or, I mean, I sort of feel like my root is that I honor the writer first, and that definitely influences the way that all the books come out.
So even after you started your press, you had books published by other presses?
Mm-hmm.
And why would you do that?
Well, I guess part of that is, you know, the insecurity of wondering if I could do it or not.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, I kind of hate to admit that's the reason, but I guess I just have to admit that. That despite the success that I did, I mean, I really did start from, I mean, I was inspired to be a writer when I was very little, you know, in grade school. And then things just take control of life, and you become, you know, I know Andy, if he ever hears this, will know exactly what I'm saying. And I was, you know, at a customer service supervisor at a cable company in Kansas, and I was sitting there, and at break, there was a bookstore half a block away, and I was literally like, that was my favorite part of the day, that 15 to 20 minutes. I'm like, oh, yeah. I keep having to remind myself that I know that words mean a lot to me. And so I would look at the books, and I would get them, and I'd read them. I just thought, I just can't give up. And I don't remember your original question now, but it was just that, I know what it was, but it's just that, I mean, you kind of do what you hope is what you're going to be good at, but you never know for sure. I mean, you never know anything for sure, for that matter. But no. There was somewhere in the back of my mind that I just thought, I just want to have some other publisher accept a book of mine.
And so what books, can you tell us all the books you've had published? The titles, in case people.
Well, the one I'm thinking of is called Pick Up Stick City, and it was done by Rivers Bend Press in Minneapolis, and it's kind of a short novella, 112 pages or something, and it was just the, you know, and I've been working that book over. Even if I sat down to write a book, it still probably would take me 10 years to do one. A lot of these, I mean, that book I've probably written most of it prior to 2000, and it came out in 2006 or 7. And I've been in a couple other anthologies. There's a River Anthology and a essays and another book. I can't even think of the publisher's name, so I'm sorry, publishers. We're always the first thing to be forgotten.
Well, do you ever think, you know, why am I putting all this time and effort into publishing other people's books? I should just be writing?
That is a good question, because that is, you know, in the last, because I get asked a lot if, you know, do you wish you were writing still? And I guess at this point, when you ask me that question, I'll say no. It's different than what I would have expected to answer, you know, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, even maybe 7 years ago. But I have actually taken a big interest in trying to help other writers and sort of seeing that process through. And, you know, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, I may look back on this whole thing and think, gosh, I really wish I'd spent more time being a writer myself. But I'm really surprised how much I like being a book publisher versus being an author all the time.
Well, you certainly can put more words out into the world as a publisher.
Yeah, that's true. And I don't really, I guess I just like the process of seeing everything through. And because one another reason why I ever even started publishing is because, you know, I always had a long history of starting things and, you know, last about 2 months and that'll be that. And for whatever reason, this is the thing that I latched onto. And I kept telling myself, no matter what, I'm going to start this and I'm going to finish it. And I'm just going to see what it means to start something and finish it all the way through. Because it's always easy to sit down and slam out 100 pages of a novel, and then you think you're getting somewhere, and then 8 months later you haven't touched it again.
Yeah, I know that one.
Or you think, oh, I'm going to send this great book out to 55 publishers, I'm going to get it accepted no matter what. And you get the first 10 people that say they're not interested, and then you just kind of go, you know, I'm just going to go on to the next thing.
How do you deal with rejection from the publisher side?
What do you mean?
Well, as a publisher, you get submissions, you have to reject things. You know, we hear a lot about, you know, the authors
heartless.
Being rejected, but yeah, how do you handle it?
I'm just heartless. Come on. Oh, no. Well, I mean, a lot of things to go into it. I mean, when I was really always trying to get a publisher all the time, it used to drive me crazy. Read publishers saying they didn't have enough books to publish, or they needed, you know, they're publishing 25 a year, and you'd read in Poet and Writers, or you'd read in the Writer's Guide Digest that they couldn't find enough books. I always thought to myself, well, it's their lucky day then, because I'm sitting in my but yet they still would reject it, and I thought, well, no wonder you don't have enough books. You don't accept them. But once you become a publisher, you realize that there's a certain limits on what you know how to do, what you're interested in, and you know, how much time you have. And I mean, one reason why I think I have enjoyed being a publisher is that I've been lucky to find authors that I really do believe in. Because it dawns on you after a number of years, a lot of things dawn on you, but when in the publishing world is that, you know, at first I didn't take submissions that seriously. And then I started realizing that, man, the things that people are submitting to me are huge projects in their life. And they've devoted so much time. Like, if I were to send this Heron book out to another publisher, you know, I would hope that my submission request would generate in their minds how much interest and concern and how much passion I have in it. But I think for me, I've had to remind myself that that's what I'm getting in the mail, is projects that, you know, other than family and work and health possibly, these are like the most involved things that people have done in their life.
Mm-hmm.
So then you start to realize, well, I can't, I mean, that alone is sometimes should be enough to get your book accepted. But then you also ask yourself on the other side, well, is this something that I'm worthy of actually even matching up with? Because if I don't, you know, if it's not something I'm passionate about, or if it's not an author that I feel like I can work with, then, I mean, it's not going to be a good match.
Right.
And as a small publisher, I don't meet every author that I work with, but I feel like I do. And I feel like we could sit around and go over their book in person, and we could market things out, and we would get along fine. And, you know, it's only over. And then when you finally realize how much time on my end I put into it, because a lot of things, you know, you're not supposed to notice in a book. You're not supposed to notice typeface. You're not supposed to notice how the margins look. But if you start noticing them for, you know, and so external, you want to notice them.
Right, right. Yeah, that's an exception. That's what makes it a unique
right.
book.
But in an average book, you know, there's some books I look at and I won't read because of the way, this might be me being picky, but there's some books I look at and I'm like, never, I couldn't read a book that looked like that.
Well, that's the issue with self-published books. If you're going to self-publish a book, get yourself a book designer.
Right. And that's part of the, you know, part of the submissions question is, well, they let me design their book so that it looks a certain way. And it just, over time, it takes so much time to publish a book, and it takes a lot of money on my part to do it. And so at the bottom line is always like, well, do I like what they have to write? And am I willing to sacrifice an incredible amount of time into this project? And I don't know, I guess I don't have an easy answer on what I pick and what I don't, but I can tell you get a ton of stuff. And it's sometimes kind of heart-wrenching to say no, because there's some things that are so on the edge that you want to take them. But
now, when I Google Ice Cube Press, what shows up, it says you're not accepting submissions. Is that true?
Yeah, it's pretty much true. It doesn't seem to slow people down, and I guess I kind of understand these things to publishers, too. I'm like, well, they say they're not accepting things, but when they see what I have, they won't be ready to take it. So, I mean, and I'm surprised, you know, a lot of people that aren't in the writing world, they really, one of the most frequent things that I'm told by other people, like, I could never work with writers, they're way too full of themselves. And I'm always like, well, I don't really notice that. But on the other hand, that's exactly the kind of person that you want as a publisher. You want a super confident writer that what they've written. And
well, true, because they also have to be confident to go out and market themselves.
Right. And just like if I read a book and it's kind of wishy-washy and they kind of make their ideas stated, then you're just like, no.
Yeah.
Have to be that person. And if you haven't worked that out yet, then we still and some people just eliminate themselves straight out of, you know, the first sentence in a query letter or something. I understand that they put a lot of effort into it, but when they just, you know, if they say, I have really keen attention to detail and the word detail is misspelled. Well, I mean, it's not really fair to reject someone on that alone.
Yeah, it kind of is.
On the other hand, you're just like, I'm only giving you a few minutes, and I mean, I could spend the rest of my life reading the submissions that I have right now.
Wow.
I'm already filled up for 2016 right now. And so even if I did take someone right now, I think, actually, I have my first book for 2017 already.
Oh, my goodness.
So,
well, that's,
and
well,
I
that's...
can do like 5 or 6 books a year. And I guess I should say on the radio, I do have a poetry contest going on now. So if someone says I don't have any, if I'm not taking any submissions, that's not actually true for me.
Okay, okay.
I started a poetry prize last year, but it's called the Prairie Seed Poetry Prize, and it's on my website. People can go there. And
is that the one that Diamond Grove Slave Tree was published?
Yes, right. He was the guy that won the first one, Javier.
Wonderful, wonderful book.
He was on a couple weeks ago.
Right.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you just tuned in, we're talking with Steve Semkin, author of Soul External, Rediscovering the Great Blue Heron, and the founder of Ice Cube Press.
Yeah. For the birds, though, I had a great, you're always shooting for reviews, I want to get in the New York Times or something, but I had someone purchase the book probably 4 or 5 months ago, and I got this email from him, and he said, hey, I'm up near Anamosa, and I just discovered a blue heron rookery. And so he invited me to come up to look at it, and we talked about it, and I was like, that is one of the best compliments that I could have got.
Right.
How often do you go visit your rookery in Kansas?
I have not been to that one for a long, long, long time.
Wow.
Because, I mean, we moved out of Kansas probably in 1995 or 6. So it's been, I guess, almost 20 years now.
Wow.
And I haven't really been to that many rookeries, which sounds awful. I guess. And we went for like maybe 7 years every season. And it is interesting to go. It was interesting to go to that particular rookery because we got so involved. Because part of the book is sort of the trail in. And so it was kind of always, it's kind of like going, if you go to church on Sundays or if you go to a certain retreat at certain times a year, or if you meditate every day, there's sort of these times when you stop and you just focus on the way you're doing things. And going to see that blue heron rookery definitely became that, for me anyway, sort of this ritual of walking in and passing this tree.
Well, Steve, we only have about 5 minutes left. Would you like to
read
a little more?
Gosh.
why don't you read another bit before we have to close?
Why don't I just read the first page?
Okay.
And then I thought that we were only like 30 minutes in.
Surprise!
Well, I'm finding the first page. Okay. I do, I have Facebook, so you can find me on Facebook, Ice Cube Press. I started doing Twitter, so you can do that. It's like at Ice Cube Press, or I have www.icecubepress.com. Throwing a shameless marketing for me. if you want to have books done by small presses, you got to find out about them and get them and all that kind of stuff.
Right, and I encourage people to support small presses and buy their books.
I I'm going to read the last page no matter what, right?
So okay, all right.
A lot of people ask about the, I say my favorite publisher pickup line. I want to do a whole series of them. So if you're submitting to me, a good publisher pickup line is, I've really enjoyed the last 3 books of yours that I purchased.
Very good.
Please read the next sentence, whatever you say after that. All right, beginning of Soul External by Steve Semkin and Andrew Driscoll. The first thing is called First Hint. The only thing necessary was a shard of evidence. I just needed some tiny hint or clue to reveal what was happening. Needed something turned in my imaginary favor to tilt and better explain the magical amalgam so coiled in my head as I sat gawking and marveling during my first excursion to a rookery of great blue herons. I wanted some proof that the birds and their habitat were real. Following the rough directions given to me from a friend, I journeyed to a spot so obscure, well concealed and safe, I trembled with the feeling of immensity. The directions involved a faint line drawing on the back of a bank deposit slip. I was told to follow a series of gravel roads until I reached a no trespassing sign. Finally, I was instructed, if anyone asks you what you're doing, just tell them you're with the Kansas Bird and Game Division. No one ever asked. Over the years, the journey to the rookery took on many meanings. Parking in front of the no trespassing sign, I even convinced myself I was with the Kansas Bird and Game Division. I slowly turned this journey to the herons into a ritual. It was a calling, a pilgrimage. But on this first trip to the rookery, my grips on sanity and reality were erased. When I arrived at the heart of the rookery, I became frazzled and lost. As above me drifted 90, perhaps more than 100, great blue herons. Mm-hmm. And then you get another 100 pages of heron stuff.
Okay, let me ask you this. Are herons ever solitary? Are they always in flocks?
That's a good question. I think, you know, during the daytime, this is what confused me also, is that during the day they seem to be by themselves, because you'll see them out, you know, stalking small fish or crayfish or frogs or something on riverbanks or something. And then it turns out, I mean, they are social creatures with these rookeries and these nests, because when you go, you see them flying in and out, coming back and forth, and there's a lot of action going on between the, you know, the male and the female, bringing sticks, offering each other a stick, or bringing food back. And so I think I would, you know, to me, I interpret them as being single, isolated creatures, but, I mean, it turns out that they're not.
Well, the reason I asked was, when we lived in Pennsylvania, we lived on in the country, and there was a stream nearby at the corner of the property, and there was a lot of timber around, and every night this bird would fly along the stream, mm-hmm. and just about sunset. And I just wonder if that was a great blue heron.
Could have been. You can tell them from a ways because the wings are pretty wide and they kind of flip out on the outside edges. But usually in the evening is when you will see them, because they're kind of making that journey back to the rookery and back to the nest and that sort of thing.
All right.
Winter, they do migrate south, so you won't see them in the wintertime.
All right. So you said you wanted to read one more little bit?
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah, that first hint was the one, but I could read a ton of, maybe I should read one of the, you guys.
Well, we only have about 1 minute, so.
Oh.
I thought maybe you'd want to read one of the prayers.
I'll just say something real quick about.
Okay, great.
I'll try and do it in a minute, but someone will pick up the book. You can get it in Amazon or bookstores. I don't know how you get them in Fairfield, but around Iowa, Eastern Iowa, there's bookstores or online stuff, but. Go to the sites and read the people that have commented on the book, because, you know, I didn't know any of the people that ended up offering blurbs for the book, and so that in itself was an incredible honor. And they did a better job of describing the book probably than I had.
Oh, yeah.
Stanislaus Kozlowski de Rola wrote this amazing book, exquisitely illustrated, takes the privileged reader on a soul awakening journey, wherein the great blue heron is revealed as a sublime psychopomp. And when you look up the word, the meaning of, I mean, he has privileged title, capitalized, and then psychopomp defined. Just go look that up. It's a great compliment. And I don't know, it was a real thrill to get all these people to respond to it.
Well, and it's an impressive book, and I can see why they responded. Yeah. And thank you so much for being with us today, Steve.
All right, thanks for having me on. That's great stuff.
Steve Semkin, author of Soul External, Rediscovering the Great Blue Heron, founder of Ice Cube Press. And Mom, do you have some final words for us today?
Well, I do. It's from the book, actually, on page 111. For now, then, the leaves have fallen off the sycamore trees. The young herons have learned to travel and eat on their own.
Now stay tuned now for Planet Earthwild, and you're getting a preview of FairFest going on this weekend here in Fairfield, down in front of the Sondheim Center. And please come out Sunday, 3 o'clock, to Art 52 for the Ink Fingers Creative Prose Contest reading. And we'll see you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUU LP 100.1 FM, produced by